differently, that she couldn't marry him because she knew him too well, and either way, it left her badly shaken. Summer was approaching, so all right, we would at least begin the process. Otherwise, I hardly needed reminding. I was risking the possibility of a life where in the in-case-of-emergency contact space, I would repeatedly be writing me. One noon hour after lunch in a nearby fish place, we strolled over to the county courthouse. There, we filled out the application for a marriage license. This license was simply a permission slip, like a hunting license. It gave us 45 days to do the deed. In that time period, one could deer hunt, using the language of this state, although, also in the language of this state, what most hunters looked for, frankly, was a nice rack, which may have accounted for my new fiancé's sudden clutching of his stomach. The clerk behind her desk raised her eyebrows. "I'm feeling some horrible pain," said the masculine owner of this new license, looking faintly green. "Seen it before," said the clerk, "but not usually this fast." "This was all his idea," I said, "or mostly."
"I think it was the fish,"
moaned you-know-who, whose name, we'll say, was Mike. "I ate the same fish," I said. "I feel fine." "You see," said the clerk. Mike was bent over in his chair, clutching his stomach, but he did not excuse himself or go anywhere else. And so this is what makes marriage possible. No one actually getting up and running away. Although a few unmarried weeks followed, in which some discussion ensued, I don't really recall any of it. The next thing I do recall is getting up and dressing in an I'll-be-damned cream-colored suit. We were on our way to the county courthouse to get married that morning, with one friend and one clerk as witnesses, and then we would be getting on a plane, flying to Seattle, and renting a car so we could drive down the small Pacific Coast Highway to Los Angeles. This would be our honeymoon. Outside in the judge's office where we were to be married, a camera crew had assembled, all sitting wearily on the corridor floor with their equipment. They were from 60 Minutes and were apparently waiting for us.
"I didn't know your short stories were that well known," exclaimed Mike, looking proud and amazed.
"Yes, well," I said, not wanting to disappoint him so soon. "What could these people want?"
"We were here earlier in the week to do a story on the governor's welfare program," they announced, "but we left without getting footage of an actual welfare couple getting married. We just need some footage, so we had to fly back last night. We heard a marriage was scheduled for this morning."
"Us?" I asked. "But we're not on welfare."
"That part doesn't matter. No one will know that. We just have to film two people getting married in this building."
This particular parsing of reality troubled me. If they were going to pretend any couple was a welfare couple, marrying to increase state benefits to themselves, as per the governor's murky thinking on the matter, thinking that briefly went national, why not also save on airfare and pretend any building was this building? It was a generic municipal building. For 10 seconds of footage, they didn't need this one. If something was already half a lie, then it was really a whole lie. So make it a whole one. The crew looked bleary, as if having just concluded a blistering gig with National Geographic. My new soon-to-be husband's face brightened. "We'd get to be on TV," he said to me, clearly game for this. That he was capable of being game for most anything, I realized, was the reason we were getting married, and the reason we would be divorced 10 years later. But it could not be a reason for our being on 60 Minutes as an ersatz welfare couple.
"God, no," I said.
The crew looked devastated. The judge's clerk shrugged. And my husband-to-be then tried this angle.
"It would be funny."
"It could be," said the head of the crew, hopefully. Although Mike would have donned a big rubber suit to play a betrothing walrus on Wild Kingdom, because it would be funny, I could not participate.
"It would be bad luck," I said. "No."
"Really?"
"Really."
"She says no," said Mike.
She says no, said the clerk to the camera crew who sat there grumbling and tired. The bride says no, said the judge himself, standing in the doorway. And that is how my marriage began. The signing of papers and saying of vows was very officey and took place under bright lights with no big city. A sweet little orchid was placed into my hand by someone. A picture I still have shows me with my hair clipped up, a way I almost never wore it unless cleaning something. Soon we were on a plane, where we were very quiet, not knowing what precisely we had done. We stared out different windows and took our respective naps, awaking to the same new fact of our lives. I thought of the James Taylor song, There We Are. Here we are like children forever, taking care of one another. I had just gotten married with no music at all. And then thought of the Dorothy Parker story, Here We Are. So how does it feel to be an old married lady, says the brand new husband in that story. Oh, it's too soon to ask me that, says the new bride. Well, I mean, goodness, we've only been married about 3 hours, haven't we? And here the husband studies his wristwatch, as if he were just acquiring the knack of reading time. We have been married exactly 2 hours and 26 minutes, he announces. My, she says, it seems like longer. When we landed at the Seattle airport, the first thing I noticed were the signs and public address system announcements in Japanese, which seemed to me another clue that marriage might involve a language I didn't actually speak. I sort of noticed my new husband looking around at all the blondes. Wisconsin had once been very blonde, but was less so now, and perhaps Seattle seemed a blast from the Scandinavian-American past and his own. But that hankering outward was perhaps a necessary gesture, a final wave farewell to all the others. Why else do so many honeymooners head for beaches? We rented a car, stayed at a nice hotel, ate soft-shell crab, and phoned our parents.
You eloped, exclaimed my mother, as if she were impressed.
I guess we had eloped, although I didn't really understand that then. There'd been no ladder up to the window, no dashing off into the night. I hadn't really thought deeply from the parental angle about our getting married this way, and now I regretted not having given it a longer, harder contemplation. I told my father about the 60 Minutes thing, thinking he would find it amusing. You should have gone on TV, then at least I could have seen you, he said, since I didn't get a chance to give you away. He didn't sound angry or even all that sad, just sort of practical. But we would have been posing as a welfare couple, I said. I thought I'd been saving him money not having a real wedding. It might have helped the sales of your books, he said, a situation he always inquired about worriedly. We'll have a fancy party of some sort when we get back and invite everyone, I said. Which we did, during which my husband never put on shoes. Just wandered around in his socks drinking beer. The next morning we had breakfast, took some sarcastic photos of the bed, unmade and strewn with the morning's Post-Intelligencer, a newspaper whose very name seemed hopelessly indicative of the occasion, and when we checked out we bought the bathrobes as souvenirs. Good for giving away to Goodwill a decade later. We rode some ferries, on which I grew woozy, drove around the rainforest, which was a mossy, magical land containing every possible hue of green. Although it was a national forest, Japanese companies were already logging in it. We would hike and drive and stumble upon denuded patches full of sunlight and machinery and noise. Then we headed south, keeping the ocean, which we never got to see in Wisconsin, in sight on our right, visiting otters and seals and dune buggy gatherings along the Oregon beaches. We stayed at bed and breakfasts that were once churches, this to compensate for having married at the county courthouse, and in general, tried not to quarrel. It was a road trip, and we had brought two tapes, Stephen Hawking's A Brief History of Time and another one called Jazz Wolf,
which featured an actual howling wolf accompanied by some alternately plaintive and jaunty jazz. We'd drive along, wordlessly, listening to the howling of that lonely wolf, its own brief history of time. The Stephen Hawking we could only understand for about 5-minute stretches, and then we'd have to rewind to listen to it over again. At this rate, the history of time would not only be far from brief, it would be a never-ending driving hazard. But I didn't want to proceed through the tape uncomprehendingly, so there was much rewinding, and then, ultimately, the frustrated substitution of Jazz Wolf. "Oh, let's just put on Jazz Wolf," became a kind of refrain for our stupidity, something we carried into the future with us. Every marriage needs a refrain. We drove down the winding Highway 1, which vertiginously hugged the California coast, producing more wooziness in me, despite the great beauty of everything. Beauty, after a while, you just don't see anymore if you're immersed in it constantly. The worry of car sickness replaced it, and I didn't know whether we should be driving slower or faster to get it all over with. Marriage. Following our guidebook, we drove through that giant redwood tree you can drive through, and in other parts of the woods, we got out. Our photo album shows me hugging the trees and my husband urinating near them. Which should tell you something, but I'm not sure what. In Mendocino, we stopped and had lunch and bought souvenirs. Though the whole place seemed preserved in time in an artificial way, the charming potheads still roamed the village streets, while the actual makers of the gift shop ceramics remained hidden to avoid possible detection and derision. Crockery mockery. Still, I thought I saw a whale, which is the kind of thing you hope for your first summer as a married woman. Eventually, after a cool, breezy day and night in San Francisco, the original shining city on a hill, where we lit a gas stove in our room and spoke incessantly of earthquakes, failing to leave our hearts or wear flowers in our hair, we turned inland and drove across the desert, which was eerily lunar, day or night. Beneath the pitch-black sky, covering us like an iron skillet lid punctured by BBs, I swore I saw UFOs, perhaps near one of the several military sites sitting spookily out there in the sand. In the daytime, litter blew apocalyptically among the cactuses. My husband wanted to go to Las Vegas, and I kept making hooker jokes, which weren't really very funny. We passed signs for Death Valley, signs for the Funeral Mountains, signs for a town called Needles, and one sign that read ZZYXRD, which I think led to Needles, and we stopped so I could take a picture of that. Once we were in Las Vegas, in an absurdly cheap room, the city was not yet the opulent place it has become, I remained upstairs reading while the mister went downstairs to gamble in the casino. No more hooker jokes. "Let's get out of here," I said in the morning. And we drove the next day to Los Angeles and ate Italian-Greek fusion dishes with artichokes and goat cheese in them in a hip, bright place. It seemed the beginning of a kind of food I'd not experienced before, cooking that was over the top and unnecessarily delicious. We roamed the streets of West Hollywood and tanned our arms in the sun. And then we flew back home, to the Midwest, to our little blue house where we'd lived for years and would live for a few more, and where our cat was waiting and happy to see us. The honeymoon was over. But that was okay. 2006. Stephen Sondheim's Sweeney Todd. Stephen Sondheim's great musical Sweeney Todd is an American Rigoletto. Both share a tone that ascends to frolic and then falls back to deepest dirge without ever losing a fine, bleak creepiness. Musical themes attach to particular characters and are replayed in both works in rousing climactic quartets. For plot, each turns on a desire for revenge upon the powerful, which backfires and costs the title characters, wronged fathers both,
the deaths of loved ones. These deaths are murders for which these once innocent baritones, in their careless vengeance, are responsible. And when their shocked, remorseful tears are shed at the end, the eyes of the audience may stay dry and unsurprised. What is mourned is lamentable inevitability, more than an actual person. In both Verdi and Sondheim, the human devil triumphs. The cruelty of men is indeed as wondrous as Peru. In both tales, virtuous women are inconvenienced by their own attractiveness and seized by men of means, a duke, a judge, each with his sinister revelers and toadies, from men of no means, a jester, a barber. The corruption, power, and greed that produce self-defeating madness in their victims are shown in both stories to be institutional, societal, political. Garden variety cleverness is no match and is transformed by the end into the romping vanity of fools. How interesting, then, that despite all its operatic affinity and grand guignol predilections, Sweeney Todd played on Broadway this past year as a stripped-down chamber concert. In this rendition, gone are the looming sets of the 1979 Harold Prince production, which sent large wooden and mechanical platforms and beams out past the proscenium of the stage, this to suggest the industrial upheaval of 19th-century London. Gone is Bryn Terfel of the 2002 Chicago Lyric production. One does not need the world's greatest living baritone for this role, as well as the thrilling, if deafening, chorus. How chorus-driven a score Sondheim has written is best discerned by a chorus of this magnitude and beauty. No humming hoofers they. And gone is the expert San Francisco Symphony, whose recent contribution staged the cast ingeniously around the orchestra and created a concert version far more theatrical than the one this year at the Eugene O'Neill Theater. Theatrical, that is, because characters interacted with one another. In director John Doyle's production, they, by and large, do not. This is for two reasons. One is that they are busy playing instruments. Cellos, violin, accordion, guitar, triangle, clarinet, trumpet, flute, and even tuba. This makes it difficult for one character to look another in the eye, even if that character is pleading to be kissed. As a result, the ardent, if fearful, young lovers are played as real buffoons as well as real cellists. Surely a first. But such a dramatic sacrifice, once the whiff of stunt evaporates, is a convenience to the second reason, the Brechtian staging, stylized alienation, that emerges at first as if by default, then later by insistence. The performers are detached in their stances, in their deliveries, and in their charmless stares out over the ticket holders' heads. They mean to cast a spell over no one, and if this Brechtian idea fails to communicate itself completely, the costumes, pulled from some Weimar cabaret trunk, much leather and fishnet, and a businessman's suitcase, white shirts and ties, indeed do help. Yet the character's instruments sometimes succeed in plaintiveness or the suggestion of a momentarily tender heart. And to hear this demon barber of Fleet Street, fiercely performed by indie rock star Michael Cerveris, who slits the throats of his despised customers, but nonetheless strums hauntingly on an acoustic guitar, is to witness a previously elusive side of Sweeney Todd, the man and the show, which is like a secret, brief and contradictory amid the standoffishness. Tenderness contiguous with ferocity. Just as the exquisitely flattened note in the tenor aria Joanna, "Even now I'm at your window," takes the victory out of win, the performance of the music has its own language, stealing past the acrobatic words. This is the genius not just of the composer, but of the simplified arrangements by the British orchestrator Sarah Travis. It is astonishing how little feels left out in this grand reduction to only 9 instruments, how much is accomplished by her adaptations, how much intimacy is gained, even if one glimpses the microphones on the cellos. The singing and playing are of a piece, organic, economical, clear. The same cannot be said of the arbitrary thrift of the abstracted stage design, which substitutes a ladder, a coffin, an apothecary's shelving, for the original barber's chair and bakehouse chute. A simple red light screams on overhead, while downstage, something resembling Cabernet Sauvignon is poured portentously from one bucket into another. The victim stands up and walks away, something done also in the San Francisco version. This particular staging may have more narrative meaning for those who know the story already. The evening I saw it, women in line for the ladies' room at intermission were shaking their heads and exclaiming, "I don't know what's going on. I can't follow it, can you?" The self-explanatory lyrics, which assist a more literal set, are witty and crisp, but quick as mice, and some will escape an unfamiliar ear. "He shaved the faces of gentlemen, who never thereafter were heard from again," is written to be sung like a brisk tumble down the stairs. Doyle's bold expressionism is probably best appreciated by someone with one other production under her belt. A forthcoming film version by Tim Burton will helpfully star Johnny Depp. Nonetheless, for those lucky enough to have seen it here or in London, Doyle's is as inspired and audacious a presentation of one of the 20th century's great works of art as one is likely to encounter. It's tricky casting. Can you act, sing beautifully, and play two instruments every night for weeks on end? Will make it difficult to reproduce. But Doyle's production should not be praised exclusively for its originality and daring. As it was presented in New York, there were smaller, more conventional decisions to admire as well. The direction of Patti LuPone, away from her more flibberty Angela Lansbury-style interpretation with the San Francisco Symphony, better suits the hard, belting quality of LuPone's voice. LuPone's wavy stingray of a mouth is an expressive, brassy creature all its own. Here is a Mrs. Lovett whose affections for Mr. Todd are perfunctory at best. She is in business with him for the new and untorn stocking she will get to wear in the second act. When she sings to him, "Always had a fondness for you, I did," LuPone is dead in the eyes as directed. Her mind is chewing gum. Unlike in San Francisco and elsewhere, where Mrs. Lovett's emotional, not just her economic, desperation is felt, her union with Todd reveals how sentimental plans, however hollow and shameless, once articulated can temporarily build a rickety alliance, a kind of honor among thieves. In By the Sea, LuPone not only hilariously mimics the scary sound of a seagull, as if dispelling the breathless squawk of Lansbury, which haunts any production of this show, but sings in her beat-up satin voice of a romantic idyll with Todd. She always refers to him as Mr. Todd, in the same way the Dustin Hoffman character in The Graduate always refers to Mrs. Robinson, formality politely conveying tarnish and impossibility. In Mrs. Lovett's fantasy cottage by the sea, they'll have a nice sunny suite for the guests to rest in. Once in a while, Todd can do the guest in. They'll be married nice and proper, but Todd should bring his chopper. Here Mrs. Lovett is more completely the Cockney Lady Macbeth she is only partially in other productions. The comedy of her best bits, however, is never lost. When we first see LuPone on her own in The Worst Pies in London, she is flicking invisible flies from invisible pies. She lures Todd in with her own tales of woe. Mrs. Mooney has a pie shop, does a business, but I notice something weird. Lately, all her neighbors' cats have disappeared. Have to hand it to her, what I calls enterprise, popping pussies into pies. Wouldn't do it in my shop, just the thought of it's enough to make you sick. And here the old prose deliberate slowing as she continues, and I'm telling you, them pussycats is quick. When she hints at her plan for human meat pies, LuPone's Mrs. Lovett is less coyly cajoling with Todd. Her voice is deadened with pragmatism. With the price of meat what it is, when you get it, if you get it. Good, you got it. Todd joins in with controlled but visibly demented glee. The history of the world, my sweet, is who gets eaten and who gets to eat. This, the operetta's signature song, A Little Priest, is a rollicking waltz that satirizes all of society and honors not just Verdi and his favorite meter, or Ravel's La Valse, which grows similarly minor and ominous as it proceeds, as if into the 20th century, or the oom-pa-pa of Lupone's own ballyhooed, though minimal, tuba playing elsewhere in the show, but self-references the immortal lyricist himself. The trouble with poet is, how do you know it's deceased? As Mrs. Lovett tries to outwit Sweeney, offering various imaginary pies. Tinker? He'd like something pinker. Taylor? He'd prefer paler. Butler? He replies subtler. Potter? He says hotter. Finally, in cool triumph, she suggests locksmith, and he is, of course, stumped. It's a poet's joke, and places the songwriter right in the song, but the characters take it up with energy and relish. Lupone may be gradually taking ownership of this role from its originator, Dame Angela. It is possible that the rouged and pigtailed Lansbury's eccentric, sharp-pitched twittering will someday seem a peculiar preference in light of Lupone's cool and sultry alto. A Broadway sacrilege to say, but that is the power of this Lupone's most iconoclastic rendition. It may lose its iconoclasm. Lupone is laying late claim to another Sondheim role too, Mama Rose in Gypsy, which she sang this past summer with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, although she was perhaps cast too true to type. The role she was born to play, boasted the advertising, and her performance there contained few surprises. Other moments of Doyle's direction constituted intriguing improvements. Judge Turpin is complicatedly less grotesque, played by the handsome Mark Jacoby in a business suit, instead of the usual white wig and judicial robes. Moreover, Jacoby's voice complements the rich sureness of Cerveris's in the gorgeously ironic death knell, Pretty Women. The duet, not overpowered by any orchestra, and aided by Travis's sensitive arrangement, particularly her plangent use of the ordinarily harsh and recalcitrant accordion, is a wonder, fascinating, combing out its hair, one of the best on record. And although it is hard to improve upon that singing chameleon Victoria Clark and her San Francisco rendition of the deranged beggar woman, Lucy, Clark has been mesmerizing Lincoln Center audiences as a rich Southern matron in The Light in the Piazza. A delicately prolonged moment when Doyle's Lucy, as played by Diana DiMarzio, lays her cheek lingeringly on Todd's arm, still not looking at him, while singing her recurrent, "Don't I Know You," is startlingly good. Director Doyle holds the moment for several extra beats. He knows what he has. A piece of physical memory is registered there more movingly than I've seen in almost any Sondheim musical. Such freeze-framing assists the story well, for it is part of the ghostly marital memory of a self-described naive man, an odd adjective uttered slowly, even uncertainly in Todd's own autobiographical ballad, which finally, if belatedly, breaks the barber down. The night I saw Sweeney Todd, Broadway's lights were dimmed in memory of Wendy Wasserstein, who had just died. Much farther south, President George W. Bush was giving his State of the Union address. At the show's close, the entire cast of 10 was standing in choral epilogue. The killed had risen, as in Elizabethan drama, and the set seemed like a cross between Assassins and Spoon River Anthology. The ensemble, their throats repaired, nimbly sang, "Sweeney wishes the world away. Sweeney's weeping for yesterday. Hugging the blade, waiting the years, hearing the music that nobody hears." Only then did I fully feel a frisson of political statement roll over the stage. A frisson that didn't die. The trouble with poet is how do you know it's deceased? Somewhere President Bush was reading, "Our differences cannot be allowed to harden into anger." Hell no, we won't go. But Sweeney Todd seemed to say, "Let them harden into rhyme. At least, try the priest." 2007. Peter Cameron. Peter Cameron is an urban novelist with an interest in the angle and viscosity of sunlight. He is an observer of greenery. It was impossible to walk along that gravel path by the sea and not think palm frond shadow. And the strength and direction of a current in a river or a stream. The sun was low in the sky and refracted in the window. He could see his own reflection, and through that, flickering in the glass, the reflection of what was ahead. Coming back to the city is always nicer in a way, because you travel in the same direction as the river. His remarking of the natural world as it intersects with the man-made is not just a seeking of ironies and metaphors, though often it is also that. An observation such as the reflection of what was ahead is lovely in its linguistic play. But more often Cameron's recitation of the physical world seems like a reminder of earthly sparkle and grit he forces upon himself. Human habitation of the planet and its great pleasantness is something he is interested in being grateful for without writing a novel that would express wholeheartedly that gratitude. There is then the strange generosity of his at least trying, of here and there defying the melancholy and ontological quibbling, his own, that impedes the enterprise. She felt like she wanted to pray, but it went no further than that. The contemporary loss of a spiritual language is the haunting subtext of almost all that he has written. In fact, Cameron writes with a sort of perfection of restraint that can sometimes make a first-time reader afraid the narrative may be too superficial or too precious or too English for ostensibly robust American reading tastes. According to interviews, the writers he most admires are the British novelists Barbara Pym, Penelope Mortimer, and Rose Macaulay, whose work has made brief appearances in his own. His main characters tend to be people who are in some fashion running away, so that the settings of his novels are often not where the protagonist ordinarily lives at all, but a place he is observing, tentatively, for the first time. As a result, though Cameron's writerly predilection, as with many novelists of manners, is for long scenes of tart conversation, the narrative often proceeds with a gingerly sort of emphasis on material objects. A pitcher of amber beer, rather than any of the people in the room, is what is most likely to seem blessedly lit from within. Luxury hotels are the real houses of God, says a character in Cameron's 1997 novel, Andorra. A mood of exile and foreignness is thus underscored, and later climactically dramatized. It is the civilized world Cameron ends up honoring, even in all its disarray, though his pen is repeatedly drawn to tidy still lifes of every sort. The natural world carefully steps back, like a sensitive suitor who knows he's been toyed with. "You would get nowhere," thinks one Cameron character, "if you were never led on." Peter Cameron began as a short story writer. Throughout the 1980s, his stories appeared with some regularity in The New Yorker, where they were exemplary of a certain spare and elegant minimalism then associated with that magazine. Soon he was writing a serial novel for the short-lived periodical 7 Days. These chapters were later published as Leap Year, 1990. And after that, despite 2-story collections, he became primarily a novelist, his most admired books being The Weekend, 1994, and Andorra. The latter set in the tiny principality of that name, tucked in the Pyrenees between Spain and France, and given a seacoast and a marina the real Andorra does not have, is something of a murder mystery and proceeds with a Mr. Ripley-style narrator, less talented than Patricia Highsmith's, but more interestingly contemplative, even if we recognize his debts and, in advance, suspect his charms. The Weekend, with its elegiac pun on weakened, touches on the subject of illness and grief in the gay community, but is simultaneously a kind of romantic frolic over a single long night, a Midsummer Night's Dream in upstate New York. In the book's title, Cameron slyly puts forward what turns out to be that novel's most haunting metaphor. What idea better sums up life's brief strain at happiness, jammed between two entities, than the idea of the weekend? Cameron has fashioned a living trope that sustains the entire book. Life is a weekend, a hinge that joins the long nothing before and the longer nothing that follows. Between the bookending emptinesses sits existence, which in Cameron's world consists of loving, dying, and visiting. There is also usually some alfresco dining, a dabbling painter or two, and alas, croquet. If Cameron's focus seems a bit too trained on privileged travel, grand houses, slight and decorative employment, artistic wannabes, and effortlessly eccentric socialites, as if every society he examines were an indolent one of 19th century dilettantes, back when the world had a certain elegant order, says one character, oblivious to whole portions of history, or if his fictional world resembles perhaps a 20th century artist's colony, well, all of his books were written in part at Yaddo or McDowell. A large house filled to the rafters with lonely creative types seems to be a kind of muse for him. Sometimes his characters quite literally live and work in turrets and attics. His novels have thus far featured, to name only a few, a rich murderer writing his memoirs, a closeted gay man at work on an opera based on Gide's The Immortalist, and several visual artists, the most recent being one who decoupages garbage cans with pages of the Bible, the Quran, and the Talmud. Cameron arranges to have this last reviewed in Art Forum under the title, When is Garbage Just Garbage? When It Stinks? I'm going to write a book about a perfect country where it's always the 19th century, says a character in The Weekend. And although his main characters are full of doubt and yearning and intelligent observation, they also may be surrounded by fatuous Lillet drinkers who make such speeches as this. Poor them. I'm afraid Ibiza is ruined, although I haven't been there in years. Perhaps it's been unruined. That can happen to places, but it takes a while. You see, a place is found, then it's lovely for a while, and then it's ruined. And then, if you're lucky, it's forgotten, and if it hasn't become too ruined, it can start again, unruin itself. It's what's going to happen to the planet eventually, I'm sure. It's only natural, and we shouldn't resist it. We'll ruin it with concrete and garbage and hairspray and blow ourselves up, and it will all lie fallow for a millennium or two, and then it will start all over again, the fish crawling out of the sea, and eventually painting the Sistine Chapel. Mark my words. It is all bleakly amusing, and Cameron has a light hand. He lets his characters satirize themselves. In his last novel, The City of Your Final Destination, 2002, travel to a half-real country, psychic claustrophobia, large old-world houses, and dubious creative and intellectual projects persist, though this time the story includes the world of literary scholarship and mines it for its spinning moral compasses and thwarted and futile figures. A University of Kansas graduate student named Omar travels to Uruguay to seek authorization for a biography of a dead writer and spends the rest of the novel among the dead author's literary executors. He is not in Kansas anymore. But the ivory tower looks like harsh reality, dusty Kansas indeed, compared to the lives lived by this reclusive, expatriated group. They, not unlike many of Cameron's characters, speak if not like actual munchkins, then like fey childlike residents of some wonderland or other. Iran? Canada? Kansas? Where is your home? Asked Caroline. I don't really know, said Omar. Kansas now, I suppose.
You will stay in Kansas? Asked Caroline.
It's difficult to get a job teaching college, said Omar. If they offer me one, I suppose I will stay there, or go wherever I can find a job.
That seems a bit strange to me, to allow a job to decide where one lives. Surely you are not so cowed by reality as that.
I'm afraid I am very cowed by reality, said Omar.
Oh? Said Caroline. Why is that?
But in Cameron's newest novel, deliciously vital right from the start, and as inviting as if less cozy than his previous ones, no one speaks like a mesmerizing airhead from another era. Though the characters are for the most part younger than in his other novels, they seem not just smarter and less desiccated, but wiser and more worldly. And the genial hum of his previous narratives has been replaced by an articulate, if paralyzed, cry, which is occasionally ratcheted up to a scream. Someday This Pain Will Be Useful to You features the ways and current crises of a Manhattan family, dismantled and demented in recognizable fashion by divorce. The first sentence alone tells you how succinctly Cameron can get to the maddened heart of the matter, the voice, the milieu. The day my sister Gillian decided to pronounce her name with a hard G was, coincidentally, the same day my mother returned, early and alone, from her honeymoon. Someday This Pain Will Be Useful to You is a piece of vocal virtuosity and possibly Cameron's best book. It retains the lucid and unlabored prose of his previous ones, but wastes less time. It may be his most successful novel on its own terms— terms that are not as modest as they may initially seem. That in many ways this novel contains the least childlike characters he has ever created makes it especially unfortunate that the publisher has already been labeling it a young adult novel. The narrator is a smart-talking 18-year-old named James Speck, who shares a bit of Holden Caulfield's snarky dismay. But he has also in common with the narrator of Andorra, a love of smooth Roman stone, and a prickly pedantic relationship to human utterance. What Peter Cameron has done is written a sophisticated and adult book, although with fewer trellises and champagne flutes and tablecloths than in his previous books, and less notice of architectural features, such as newels and cornices. People speak less formally to one another, and more confrontationally, and use contractions. No one is likely to say they've slept marvelously the night before. They are more likely not to have slept at all. I can't believe you didn't notice I was missing, I said.
Get a life, James, said Gillian.
I just thought someone might notice that I never came home.
Oh, we would eventually, said my mother. You just have to stay away a bit longer next time.
In addition to bracingly comic dialogue, the novel possesses too much emotional complexity and artfulness of construction to exclude adult readers. For instance, the desire of a young man simply to be seen, let alone seen for what he is given several plot strands, two different instances of running away, and one elaborate instance of posing as someone else in a computer chat room, all to win notice. Similar assessments, of course, can be made of Great Expectations, as well as the most famous of American boy narrators, Huckleberry Finn. And then there is The Catcher in the Rye itself. And although one would hesitate to place Cameron's novel in all this immortal company, Someday This Pain Will Be Useful to You will very likely elicit comparisons both to those great books and to more recent ones by, say, Jonathan Safran Foer or Benjamin Kunkel. James's best friend is not a fellow teenager, but his grandmother in New Jersey, who refers to herself as the poor man's Kitty Carlisle Hart. His father works in a high-security midtown skyscraper, has a Deben corn in his sun-filled office, and is about to have some cosmetic surgery on his eyes. As a kind of preemptive strike, or out of idle and insensitive curiosity, he asks James if he is gay. James's mother, a thrice-married art dealer whose latest husband has absconded with her credit cards and whose assistant is gay, also asks James if he is gay. James's sister, dating a language theory professor named Rainer Maria Schultz, is the only one in the family who doesn't ask. She is described by the flap copy as his mordant older sister. But this is not her story. James's longest discussions are with his mother and his therapist, whom the flap copy refers to as Teutonic. Cameron's prose, however, takes us out of labels and types of every kind.
"Well, you don't think it's weird?" Gillian asked Rainer Maria. "An 18-year-old boy who visits his grandmother?"
"No," said Rainer Maria. "You Americans have so little family feeling. In Germany, we love our grandparents."
"I'm not saying you shouldn't love them," said Gillian. "I just think visiting them is weird. It will be so good for you to go away to school, James."
"I've decided I'm not going to college," I said.
"What? Since when?"
"Today. I'm thinking about moving to the Midwest."
"The Midwest? The Midwest of what?"
"The United States," I said. "The Prairie States."
"The Prairie States? I think you've read my Antonia one too many times."
"Hush, Gillian. I think it is a very good plan for you, James," said Rainer Maria. "The college experience in the United States is a farce."
"Hello," said Gillian. "You teach in a college."
"My dear Gillian, if everyone had to believe in the work he did, not much would get done in the world," said Rainer Maria.
James quite candidly does not care for people his own age, or so he says, or perhaps this is a convenience, as Cameron has always been more interested in the grown-up world, especially young adults and very old ones, even if they are childlike in their conduct. The social canvas and range of dramatic action here may seem deceptively narrow. A high school senior who lives with his mother and sister visits his father, grandmother, and therapists, recalls a brief misadventure at an academic teen conference in Washington, D.C. called the American Classroom, makes a mess of a crush he has on his mother's assistant, but this apparent quietness is not atypical for Cameron, nor is it a narrative strategy in which we are privy to the subdued wit of even the angriest and most unhappy people. For a moment, I could tell my mother didn't get what I meant, and then she got it. She looked at me with a sort of hurt, amazed expression.
"You think I'm a tyrant?"
"I think you have tendencies toward tyranny," I said.
Neither young adult literature, nor even really a coming-of-age story, "Someday This Pain Will Be Useful to You," is most surprisingly of all the subtlest September 11th novel yet written, if one can speak of the September 11th novel as a genre, and I think, with respect, that one can. So accomplished is its subtlety that one is not even aware of this novel's true subject until three-quarters of the way through, and then its mention.
"You know, we've never talked about September 11th.
A remark made rather late in the day by James's therapist rises up out of the story's barely submerged anxiety. It is perhaps initially casually planted there by James's ominous visit to his father's high-in-the-clouds office and casts on the book a sudden brilliant light. James has been wanting to skip college and use his tuition money to buy a house in the Midwest. Now we see why. 2 years before, he had been in 10th grade at Stuyvesant High School, within close view of the World Trade Center when it was attacked.
"I'm thinking about the woman who died on September 11th, who no one knew was missing," James says to his therapist, and then continues to himself. "To die like that? To disappear without a trace? To sink without disturbing the surface of the water? Not even a telltale bubble rising to the surface, like sneaking out of a party so no one notices you're gone."
Disappearance of every sort has become James's fearful fascination,
A child's sense of safety in the world has been catastrophically undermined. And although this is a novel full of precise skeptical observations about everything from art galleries to divorce to looking for love in New York City, its real subject is what happens to children when they witness terrible violence. How is such an event moved on from? Who do these children become when they are grown, and what faith is no longer possible for them as they continue to live in an anarchic world that still somehow brims with pleasure, beauty, and love? James's response lies in a kind of repudiation of death. Memories will be stored in things. Perhaps, he imagines, love could naturally result in clairvoyance. The possessions of a beloved might lend their holy voodoo. When his grandmother leaves him her ghostly remnants, all her possessions, his parents want him to sell them to an estate liquidator. That's the word they use, liquidate, but I refused. With some of the money my grandmother left me, I'm paying to have everything stored in a climate-controlled warehouse in Long Island City. As in all of Cameron's work, the past is both longed for and swept away. James's climate-controlled warehouse is his own sort of church with its own congregation, a shakily stubborn protest against time, change, and disappearance. It is a bravura performance, and someday this pain will be useful to you, is a stunning little book, a demonstration that adolescence, like a weekend, or the countries of Andorra or Uruguay, may seem an awkward, otherworldly way station suspended between two more prominent and fixed points, France and Spain, Brazil and Argentina, the long, numb workaday weeks that may appear to represent an absence from living. Yet it remains a fundamental place in the human psyche from which no one ever really moves on. I was beginning to realize that the adult world was as nonsensically brutal and socially perilous as the kingdom of childhood. Poised between childhood and adulthood, adolescence stands there for a short, vivid time, howling like a dog. Eventually, it is simply buried, but buried alive. 2007. Donald Bartlemy. When, within a year's time, both Raymond Carver and Donald Bartlemy succumbed in their 50s to cancer, Carver in August 1988, Bartlemy that next July, it was as if the reigning president and vice president of the American short story had suddenly died. Both were beloved by peers and acolytes, though they struggled for readers, and each, in separate decades, had revitalized the genre that since the invention of television has been continually pronounced both moribund and in a condition of renaissance, recovering from moribund. Both writers were inimitable, even as they were widely imitated. Carver, younger, less productive, a practitioner of a spare, gritty realism, often called minimalism, was the junior executive. Donald Bartlemy, sparkling fabulist and idiosyncratic reinventor of the genre, practitioner of swift verbal collages, also sometimes dubbed minimalism, was commander-in-chief. Bartlemy's particular brilliance was so original, so sui generis, despite its tutelage at the feet of pages by Joyce, Beckett, and Stein, that even his own brothers, Frederick and Stephen, also fiction writers of intelligence and style, wrote more like Carver. Carver and Bartlemy were hard-drinking Westerners, men's men, and alcohol and cigarettes eased their isolation, regional and existential, in a literary life amid East Coast institutions, bohemian and otherwise, though in the end both died prematurely as a result. The cultural sea changes of their adult decades were enormous, and one is reminded of all the Prohibition-era addictions that were acquired by jazz-agers in the 1920s, young people navigating similar renegotiations of social mores. Perhaps artists of any time tend to possess introverted dispositions
that need bracing and enlivening to exude even the cool, feigned indifference preferred in Bartleby's later 1950s jazz age. Edward worried about his drinking, Bartleby wrote in an early story. Would there be enough gin, enough ice? There is no indication in Tracy Doherty's thorough new biography of Bartleby, Hiding Man, that these two late great masters of the short story ever actually met, though Doherty's title could be used to caption the life of either of them, as it might be the appropriate title for any number of literary biographies, since presumably a writer has lived his life more on the page than off, and in such a distorted, imaginary, and playful fashion that he or she steps away from his desk and walks out into that other world, half-formed, half-spent, half-there, those particular fractions being optimistic. Donald Bartleby was born in 1931, the namesake and eldest son of Donald Bartleby Sr., a Houston architect of distinction and renown and of formidability to his children, all of whom were gifted and successful and desired to please him. Frederick and Stephen became professors and novelists. The only girl, Joan, became the first woman vice president of Pennzoil. A third brother, Peter, became a successful advertising executive and wrote mystery novels. Helen Bechtold, their adored mother, was a beauty and a wit. Donald Jr.'s second wife and lifelong friend, Helen Moore Bartleby, in an admiring memoir she wrote, even after being dumped for a younger woman, compared them all to the James family. Henry, not Jesse, though perhaps, it being the West, there was a touch of both. In stature and accomplishment. The family home, as a material structure and as a venue for intellectual conversation, stood out in Houston. The house was designed by their father and was part of his modernist crusade. The furniture was architect furniture, a lot of swoopy Scandinavian stuff, according to the baby of the brood, Stephen. Moreover, the master bedroom had no door, which seems almost unimaginable for that era. Both Donalds revered as biblical Marcel Raymond's From Baudelaire to Surrealism, a book presented to the son by his dad. In view of all this, that Donald Bartleby the writer would marry a woman with the same name as his mother, then later travel to Scandinavia and marry a Dane, read the writings of Freud, become famous for his own aesthetic crusade, and pen a novel, Oedipally titled The Dead Father, might seem something of a foregone conclusion and a biographer's delight, or perhaps in the way of foregone conclusions, a biographer's headache. Moreover, the first part of Tracy Doherty's book has to negotiate many ambiguous antecedents and much referential confusion about which Donald Bartleby it is discussing, père or fils. Later in life, the father's entry in Who's Who was still much longer than the son's, which gave the junior Bartleby a good guffaw. Mr. Bartleby, the architect, was also given to cleverness and mischief similar to his son's. When he designed Texas's Hall of State, he had carved into the frieze of the building the names of 59 legendary Texans, according to Doherty. The first letters of the first 8 names, reading left to right, Burleson, Archer, Rusk, Travis, Higg, Ellis, Lamar, and Millam, spell the architect's name, minus only the final E. A playful touch, a buried secret. These would become hallmarks of his eldest son's art as well. The son's life was full of fits and starts. There was Catholic school and a desire to be part of the arts, but which one? There was college interrupted and gone uncompleted. There were, eventually, 4 marriages. There were early stabs at newspaper work, music, he was briefly the drummer in a touring band, museum directing, journal editing. What he most needed took him a surprisingly long time to do, leave Houston and move to New York. A stint as a soldier in Korea, 2 Texan marriages, and 4 dead babies with his second wife,
infants whose bodies were given to medical research, so there were no graves and no old-fashioned style mourning, perhaps took the wind out of his sails. His first wife said she left him because she wanted to see the world and Don didn't. But his restlessness and unhappiness in Houston had to be diagnosed by a psychotherapist as his simply needing to get out of town. He began to believe it.